your show is certainly an important component of that. Your show, as you must know, is widely monitored.
Well, I would hope so.
Oh, there's no question about it, and I know that for a fact. Your show is extremely monitored.
Well, I'm sure that I've made a couple of the FBI digests, if not the main volume.
And you would be missed if you were not there. So I want to get in that commendation for you. And you do a lot of good work, Mr. Norris. I don't agree with all your issues, but I agree with your integrity. Needs to be...
Please, you're embarrassing,
lauded.
Uncle Bob.
It needs to be lauded.
Thank you very much.
So, Happy New Year, Robert.
And the same to you, Bob.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye. Well, phone lines are open here at Free Radio as we struggle with the failing equipment. Looks like the recording deck is going down for the third time. I'm manually holding it in place here. The phone number, however, if you want to call in, I think our phone lines are still operational. You can hear that they seem to be. 427-3772. I want to talk about police behavior on New Year's Eve. According to Suffren Bob, the cop watch man, what I heard yesterday, it was they were very fast. It was police were everywhere, and they had the reaction time was minutes to seconds in removing the unsightly from the street and in dealing with real problems as well, which I suppose is good. But again, you have to ask yourself, do you want to pay for it by having police everywhere and having people getting the kind of treatment that they got when people got, within a space of half an hour, tickets for putting down an orange peel in a planter, one orange part of an orange peel, sitting near the abandoned Cat and Canary clothing store. That was a harassment thing and not a ticket. Tickets for amplified music, for having your radio too loud in a vehicle because it seemed to be one of those driving while brown stops, all by Officer Eveleth. This pumping up of the police department and the budget and the number of police officers on the street tends to result in, well, decisions by the police, more power by the police, more control by the police. And the question is that what we want here in Santa Cruz? Is that what we want in this country? With the crime rate dropping, why are police expenditures rising? Maybe you have the answer. Give me a call, 427-3772. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And we're going to be doing a little reviewing as well, as soon as I'm able to take my finger off the button here. A couple of interesting stories on the boot camp issue. I don't know if you're familiar with this thing. It's, well, let's begin with story about Maryland is the latest to rethink boot camps. That's a story in one of the Baltimore papers. And it's reads as follows. In the face of a looming scandal, Maryland shut down its once ballyhooed boot camp regimen for juvenile offenders last week, providing further evidence of grave second thoughts across the nation about the get-tough camps avidly favored by politicians during the last decade. After an emergency in...
You're welcome.
Yes, thank you. That's that man on the scene, the V-man, fixing the machine here. Always good to have a little on-the-spot repairing. After an emergency investigation concluded there was a pattern of guards punishing teenage inmates with roughhouse abuses, Governor Paris Glendening suspended the paramilitary methods and trappings at the state's three camps and removed his top five justice executives. Oh, sounds like a clean sweep. At the same time, 14 of the quasi-drill sergeant camp guards were suspended as criminal and civil rights investigations began. One guard has already been charged with child abuse. The trust of the people of Maryland has been violated, the governor declared, as the scandal, spurred by a series of articles in the Sun newspaper, reached crisis proportions with a Baltimore judge intervening, there we go, to remove 26 juveniles from the camps and expressing grave concern at the teenage offenders' many complaints about abusive guards. Interrupting the story, it's always interesting to find where the reform or action initiated from, and it didn't come from the governor until it came from a judge, it looks like. And probably didn't come from the judge until it came from the newspapers and their expose series. So I think we can thank probably the media for this, although, again, I don't have all the facts here. The boot camp approach to juvenile criminals based on enforcing rugged military obedience techniques of verbal and physical regimentation has been adopted in recent years in many states, frustrated by youth crime. But lately, some of the 52 boot camps housing 4,500 juveniles across the country are being scrutinized because of instances of excessive force, and even more because of mounting research findings that the camps, for all their attempts at esprit de corps and rigid discipline, offer no improvement on traditional detention methods. In Georgia, where a former Marine received national attention in pioneering the boot camp approach, the state decided this month to begin phasing out, that was in December, its five boot camps after a stinging conclusion by the U.S. Justice Department that the paramilitary boot camp model is not only ineffective, but harmful to juvenile offenders. Colorado, North Dakota, and Arizona have also dropped their programs, while Florida and California are scaling theirs back. Official doubts have been growing in the face of some notorious examples of abuses. In South Dakota, Gina Score, a 14-year-old convicted of shoplifting, died from heat exhaustion after her drill instructors concluded that she was faking illness during a forced march. Last year, Nicholas Contreras, a 16-year-old convicted of robbery, died in an Arizona boot camp after being punished for discipline violations. The boot camps are just the crisis of the day, said Jan Jackson, executive director of Advocates for Children and Youth, a private justice agency who served here on the governor's emergency investigation of the camps. It reflects far deeper systematic problems in a justice system that has been failing kids for years, from the moment of intake to aftercare. Various juvenile justice and welfare advocates said in interviews that Maryland officials had received repeated earlier warnings of widespread problems in youth detention centers, but had ignored them, until The Sun reported a pattern of abuses by boot camp guards and pressed political leaders for reaction. Glendening and Lieutenant Governor Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, who was charged with overseeing the criminal justice system, announced the firings on Thursdays after a week of front-page accusations that teenagers were struck and gratuitously humiliated by overzealous guards in the 3 years of the program. The boot camp is a model that lends itself to abuses, said Jim McComb, chairman of the Maryland Juvenile Justice Coalition, a group of professional specialists that was warning of problems long before the current scandal. There is no evidence that the camps do any good, McComb said. Why take the risk of abusing children to defend the camps, he asked, after Glendening asserted that despite current problems, a way might yet be found to make the boot camp an effective tool. Various members of the coalition opposed to boot camps expressed concern that the Glendening administration would retain a, quote, get-tough philosophy to protect itself politically while leaving unsolved large and expensive problems like crowding throughout the juvenile system. The answers go far beyond firing five people, said Vincent Schiraldi, executive director of the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. For all the news media attention to the boot camps, Schiraldi said, state officials have long been warned about less dramatic problems at the Cheltenham Detention Center, where he said 100 detainees were sleeping crowded into a day room designed for recreation by 26 people. That's 100 detainees in a room for 26 people. In a national study of recidivism this year by the Coach Crime Institute, a research organization in Topeka, Kansas, the rates for juveniles from boot camps range from 64% to 75%, that's of recidivism, while the rates for those from traditional detention centers were 63% to 71%. In other words, people in boot camps were more likely to recommit crimes than those who were in other prison institutions. We were aware of the boot camp problems and terminated seven of the guards even before this brouhaha, said Jack Nadal, Maryland's Deputy Secretary of Juvenile Justice, who refused to resign and was fired by the governor. I think the articles sensationalized the problem and didn't show the kids who have gone on to college or to the military. Even so, Nadal conceded in an interview that the camps failed to have on-site monitors of the guards' behavior and that a boot camp supervisor empowered to use force against abrasive detainees under limited circumstances, quote, can get carried away with his sense of influence and power. I think there was some abuse, Nadal acknowledged, while emphasizing when the camps were first unveiled in an optimistic burst of publicity, the assigned detainees consisted of the best that was out there and we rejected the rest. But soon drug abusers and ever tougher cases were assigned to the camps, he said, putting added pressure on supervisors to maintain order. And I think we have a little bit more of that story. I'm not excusing abuses, he said, but the real systematic problem in the agencies is that we do not have enough mental health treatment, substance abuse treatment, and a whole range of aftercare that is lacking. Nadal insisted that his was a token firing, and he said he intended to pursue the cause from the private sector. My concern is people will get their 20-second sound bites and the whole thing will disappear, he said, echoing the concern of system watchdogs like McComb, the head of the State Juvenile Justice Coalition and director of the Maryland Association of Resources for Families and Youth. The fact is, the Department of Juvenile Justice for 15 to 20 years has done nothing to respond to all the symptoms of trouble, McComb said. So here's the real test, to see if they do something, anything more than fire a secretary who never had a true background in juvenile justice, he said, of the ousted State Justice Secretary Gilberto de Jesus. The systematic problems have lasted through the best and worst of secretaries. And there actually was a follow-up article, again, about boot camps in... Again, I think it's probably the Baltimore Sun, but it may have been a broader internet story. It's not clear. It came over the internet. It's by Jason Blair, Boot Camps, an Idea Whose Time Came and Went. Ah, yes, this is a New York Times story from today's New York Times. 5 years ago, responding to an increase in serious juvenile crime, the state of Maryland initiated one of the nation's largest boot camp programs for teenage criminals. The program, called the Leadership Challenge, quickly became the model for other states, but last week, after reviewing a task force report that documented instances of physical abuse at their camps, Maryland officials appeared on the verge of conceding that the current initiative was a failure. The Maryland experience, together with the problems in other states, has already led some states to close their boot camps and even to rethink how their penal laws treat young offenders. All in all, it is a remarkable turn of events for an idea that was once greeted as a breakthrough in the fight against juvenile crime. There is increasing evidence that boot camps never worked. A national study last year by the Coach Crime Institute, a public policy group in Topeka, showed, as I mentioned before, recidivism among boot camp attendees ranged from 64% to 75%, slightly higher than for youth sentenced to adult prisons. Gerald Wells, senior research associate at the Institute, said of the report, "The shocking parts are the allegations of abuse, but the more alarming parts are the failures." Research has also shown, according to Mr. Wells and other penal justice experts, that these camps were grounded in a false and unexamined assumption. People thought boot camps shaped up a lot of servicemen during three wars, Mr. Wells added. But just because you place someone in a highly structured environment with discipline does not mean once they get home and are out of that, they will be model citizens. Boot camps have their roots in the 1970s, with the advent of large, well-organized, and extremely violent street gangs. In response to these gangs, many states began to imprison more young people. By the 1990s, as the number of repeat juvenile offenders rose to record levels, it became clear that prison sentences were not working. In 1994, nearly 10,000 juveniles were charged with criminal offenses, an all-time high. More than 2,300 of them were charged with murder, compared with fewer than 1,000 in 1980, according to the Justice Department's Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. On any given day, about 105,000 children were in custody on criminal charges in the United States. It was in this atmosphere that Lieutenant Governor Kathleen Kennedy Townsend of Maryland began exploring the potential of boot camps. Shortly after being elected with Governor Paris N. Glendenning in 1994, Ms. Townsend, a former Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Clinton administration, said she considered boot camps, quote, a cost-effective intermediate punishment and included them among her priorities. Ms. Townsend has said the idea came from visiting a juvenile boot camp in Ohio. By then, a handful of states, including Georgia, Louisiana, West Virginia, and Ohio, had begun well-publicized, promising experiments with juvenile camps. The camps, modeled after similar programs that popped up in England in the 1970s, were designed for juveniles who had committed moderately serious crimes, such as auto theft, with the goal of interceding before they moved to more serious crimes. By 1997, more than 27,000 teenagers were passing through 54 camps in 23 states annually. The people who ran the real boot camps were quite skeptical. The key reason we are successful is that we have a clientele down here that chose to be here on their own, said Sergeant Major Ford Kinsley, who oversees drill instructors at the United States Marine Corps recruitment base in a Parris Island, South Carolina camp. They are not here because a judge said you should go here. Our population comes from a lot more positive attitudes. He said that when a kid graduates from Parris Island, he is just beginning a 4 or 5 enlistment in the Marine Corps. It's not like they spend 11 months here and we just throw them out into the streets. Then, too, the Marines traditionally choose the best of its non-commissioned officers as boot camp instructors. By contrast, state standards vary widely. Rumors began to surface of beatings at Maryland's boot camps last August, and Ms. Townsend ordered an end to all inappropriate physical contact. But news reports in December suggesting such violations had continued led Ms. Townsend and Mr. Glendenning to launch an investigatory task force chaired by former Baltimore Police Commissioner Bishop T. Robinson, who also spent 10 years in charge of the state's prison system. On December 15th, the task force released a report that accused guards of routine and brutal beatings of inmates, and Mr. Glendenning and Ms. Townsend suspended the state's camps and dismissed the top 5 juvenile justice officials. Similar accusations have led state and local officials in Colorado, Arizona, and North Dakota to drop their programs, while Florida and California are scaling back theirs. In Georgia, officials revamped their program after a Justice Department investigation concluded that the state's paramilitary boot camp model is not only ineffective, but harmful. Some experts regard the entire boot camp experiment as a cynical political maneuver. Boot camps are just another knee-jerk reaction, a way to get tough with juveniles that resonated with the public and became a political answer, said Dr. David M. Altshuler, a juvenile justice expert at the Institute for Policy Studies at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Still, some believe the programs, in some form, can be useful. These are tough kids with tough problems. They need good education and drug treatment. They also need to learn respect, self-respect, discipline, and a new way of conducting themselves in society, Ms. Townsend said. Facilities that provide structure and discipline can be run effectively and have a role in our fight after juvenile crime. Of course, this is the same woman who proposed them initially. Many experts disagree, citing the expense of running such programs properly. It's a budget issue, said Doris McKenzie, a University of Maryland criminology professor. They are popular in the public. People feel we should treat these kids tough, and everyone can get onto the bandwagon, she said. But when it comes to the extra expense of doing the follow-up, we find the money is not there. In any case, juvenile crime has been falling since 1994, after an overall drop in the nation's juvenile population. This will make it highly unlikely, say political observers, that voters will agree to pay for individualized rehabilitation. Much more likely, they say, is that the 27,000 young people who once went to boot camp each year will instead be sent to prison. As bad as boot camps have proved to be, Mr. Wells added, once you start incarcerating kids, you have lost. But unfortunately, that's where we seem to be headed. And that is from the New York Times. Bad news, I must say. And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Seem to be having many a problem here today, trying to get these machines a-working. Maybe I just have some blank tapes here. Could that be it? We will have to see. If you want to call in on any of these subjects, again, our phone number is 427-3772. Let's try a little relief here.
We Texans on our cattle ranches like our cows. Insult them and you insult me. We'll give you a sandwich in your kisser pals. If we don't like what we see on TV, who is she? Oh, pro Oprah Winfrey, there's a lawyer I'd like you to greet. Though we all agree that speech is free, don't you dare say nothing about our meat. Oh, overseas they got a cow or two that's gotten mean, and they say that it's the reason Brits like the Spice Girls, Charles and the Queen. Because Oprah said cows are bad, now they're angry and they may go mad. Now they'll fight back.
Moo!
It's cows on the attack.
Moo you!
That got that's on your burger, it ain't mustard, fella. It is yellow. B-A-C-T-E-R-I-A. Salmonella.
Talking to a man who got a camping ticket up at UCS a couple months ago. What happened?
I was camping there. I had set my food outside the tent so that, you know, I wouldn't have it inside. Of course, I always clean up my mess and everything. And they came, woke me up in the morning, said a jogger had complained, and I was camped out in the middle of the meadow. And they gave me a ticket for camping, took pictures, and sent me on my way.
Who is they? UCSC police? Or?
UCSC police.
And what time did they do this?
About 7 o'clock in the morning.
And did they offer you another place to go that would be safer or more legal?
No, they never offered me another place to go, more safer or legal.
You were in a tent? Or?
Yeah, you have to be in a tent in the meadows there because of the bugs. And the cop told me that if I was just out in the open, exposed to the elements, that it would be legal.
Really?
Yeah. That's what he told me.
That's an interesting claim. That's, of course, not true because the camping ban in the city extends at least to half the campus, and there's another ban on camping or sleeping as well that extends to the other half, which is a UC ordinance. So it sounds like it's interesting what he told you, but that's not been the accepted practice or the accepted law. So
this was in the meadow next to family housing.
Right, well, the city camping ban covers half the campus, and as I said, the rest of the campus is covered by a UC ordinance, which is essentially a copycat camping ordinance, kind of written in with a local ordinance in mind. Anything else about this you want to point out?
I don't quite understand it.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Okay, we're talking to
Richard Williams.
And Richard, you have a concern about homeless families.
Yes, I do. There's, at any given time, there's anywhere from 15 to 30 families, people with children in school. They're paying ridiculous prices in motels to live. And their money runs out, and they really didn't have problems. And something really needs to be done about it. I know that some people have task force have talked about shelters and everything else, but those take time. It's going to take a long time.
That's right.
But if somebody could just get it together and we could get 20 acres of land and using GI squad tents, they did some of these floods and other places, they set these alternative places up. Let there be a camp. Let them start helping each other, families. Because it's really a need, and there's just so much out here. And families could really stay together if they had a place like this. But this way things are going now, I wonder if some of the fathers would go out and get drunk and do other things just to get away from the crap that goes on, situations they're in. I've been sober 32 years, and I worked with a lot of people. And I want to do it again. I'd love to be able to work with some of these people. But if you can get them a place where they can go and be, you can't do anything with them.
You're also interested in bringing these folks to the Homeless Issues Task Force, some of these families?
Yes, we're going to try to get about 15 or 20 families to the next meeting. Maybe even City Hall, a City Council meeting, I don't know. But it's about time something's done, and I've been talking about it for a year, and we'll see what we can do.
Hey, Richard, much appreciated. Thank you.
See you around.
All right, Ben.
You got to read?
It's a little bit before parade time here in downtown Santa Cruz. It's still light, but threatening to get dark, and we're talking to
Tess Armello.
Tess, I just handed you a flyer about police misconduct, and a look of recognition came into your eyes. What was that about?
Well, a few years ago, my two brothers were assaulted by police officers. They were beaten pretty badly at the jailhouse and treated, you know, less than human.
Where was this?
In Santa Cruz.
Do we know the names of the police officers who did this?
I don't know.
And do we? What were the circumstances?
There was, let's see. They were at a bar in Scotts Valley. They were picked up there for, somebody had started a bar brawl. And they were brought downtown. And one of my brothers was beaten so bad that he was knocked unconscious. And
what's your brother's name?
The one that got beat unconscious was Steve Schubeck.
Uh-huh.
And the other brother, Dan Schubeck, was also beaten, had contusions on his head and bruises all over his body. My brother Steve was beat up so bad he had bruises all over his back, and he even wet his pants, and it was bad. He was beat up pretty bad.
What was there any response? Did you take a complaint to the police department? Did they complain?
I think they dropped the matter for some reason, and I'm not sure about the other details around that.
You didn't take it to court or anything?
No. I think they should have.
And are your brothers still living in town?
No, one is living in Florida, and one is in Aptos now.
Is that related to this beating at all, or is it just coincidental?
No, just coincidental. Yeah, it was coincidental.
How are police treated you, Jenna?
Harry Christmas.
And Harry Hoo-ha to you, buddy.
What was that?
Have you been, how about yourself? Are you a longtime resident of Santa Cruz?
Yes, I am.
And you has your attitude towards the police changed as a consequence of this experience?
It makes me feel insecure about our police force. But that was a while ago, and I think that there was other incidences with these police officers, and they were reprimanded for other overzealous
kicking the shit out of citizens.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Right. Right.
So, when was this? What year? Do you remember?
What year was that, Mark? In the 80s? Late 80s, maybe?
So hopefully times have changed.
Oh, I hope so, because, that's...
Well, see, tonight, they did a lot of training exercises for tonight. They have their riot shields, their batons, and they're going to keep the peace, even if it keeps us all in pieces. No, we're hoping that all will be mellow tonight. I want to thank you for letting Free Radio know. We'll be playing this on Sunday.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Well, the parade is over. It's about... Well, after 7, and we're here with the man who knows how the alcoholics are treated on the beach, Stolen Roland. Hey there, Roland.
Oh, hi, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. You say that some alcoholics on the beach are getting the rouse?
Well, I go down there, and I do play volleyball occasionally, and they're drinking. Nobody's being bothered them, but the alcoholics on the top, constantly being harassed, constantly giving tickets, constantly taking their alcohol away from them, and being out and out bothered. One was walking across Seascape, one of the parking lots, which everybody does, and he was arrested for trespassing.
5 hours. 5 hours.
That's pretty bogus to me. Anything else to report?
That's about it for now.
Thank you, Roland.
I've seen them a number of times just go out of their way to pick on homeless alcoholics at the beach.
Thank you. Oh, we're here at, within 30 feet of the ATM machine. You're under arrest. Ha ha. Happy holidays, homeless, please help. And we're talking to a man on the sidewalk. How are you doing, sir?
Not too bad.
And how are people treating you today on the Christmas day or day before Christmas?
Like I don't exist.
So it looks like, I don't see any $5 bills in there. I think people are reserving their money for the Gap and for the shoe shops.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm actually out here trying to sell a little jewelry, so.
I see. You got some jewelry there for sale. Officer, arrest this man. No, just kidding.
Yeah.
Any hassles you've seen of homeless people or police problems?
Actually, for Santa Cruz, I'm kind of surprised I haven't been hassled yet.
How long have you been out here?
This time, about 3 weeks.
Well, that's great.
I was out here for about a year the last time I was down here, and that was a couple years back.
Your name is?
Wolf.
Well, thank you for sharing with us. Anything you want to add for folks to know about?
No, just when you see people on the street, don't kick them.
Don't kick them when they're down.
Yeah.
Or perhaps, as our mayor would say, well, we'll leave that alone for the moment.
And it's January 1st, 2000, about 3:40. Just got a call from Dan Hopkins. And Dan, what did Dan say?
Dan said that there's a band that is playing on top of the old Woolworth building, and they've locked the doors, and the cops are trying to get in and stop this band from playing, and they can't get in because all the doors are locked. They're trying to get in through some other businesses to get at these criminal music players.
Music on New Year's Day. Can you imagine? Well, we're down here across from Woolworth, so it looks like there is a squad car double parked down here at Walnut and Pacific on Pacific Street. But I hear no sounds of music. I see a police officer crossing the street, Robert, turning to his car. Hey guys, did we miss all the fun? What happened? Nothing? No? Something about somebody on the Woolworths roof? No?
And it was really good. He should have been on the ball.
So, Dan, you have your lapel and your boombox with you.
Yeah.
Nobody else seems to have seen anything. Did you actually see people on the roof of Woolworths?
Oh, yeah. They're still up there, I think, but they're not in sight right now. But there was several children, about, you know, preteens, and many adults, and they were playing, like, professional band, you know. It was, like, techno stuff and things like that. And they actually sounded like a band that just came through town called Lost at Last. And it's a really, really good band.
How long were they up there for?
Well, actually, they're still up there, and they were here when I got here. It's been at least a half an hour already, and they were playing really loud, you know. You could hear it all the way through the mall. And I think it must have been some kind of revolutionary thing. But anyway, what I heard is that they locked all the doors so that no one could come up and get them off the roof. So they're still up there as far as I know. And they said that the police came earlier, and they were all around the building, a whole bunch of police, but they couldn't...
Who said this?
One of the people that were standing right there on the corner that was watching the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
And just before I got there, he said that there was all kinds of police there, and they couldn't figure out a way to get upside the building because there's no way to grab onto anything, you know?
So it's now about 3:45.
Right.
How long have they stopped playing for?
They've only stopped about 5 minutes ago. Yeah, and a police officer came, and then he went down about three or four businesses down through the back alley there. He went up to a place called Bistro Cafe, and he went up there, and they might have had a roof entrance or something, because just within seconds after he went up there, they stopped playing, you know. And actually, I believe the people are still up there. How soon they're going to come down, I don't know. But the police officer just drove away. Either they're going to go get a fire truck to get him off of there, or maybe he already made contact with them and they peacefully left, you know,
because
they have stopped playing. But it was I figure it's a really act of rebellion, you know.
So who else was here? You want to point me to a few of the witnesses here?
Good, man. You know, they're really, really good. And so you weren't here whenever this was all going on, huh?
We just showed up and we saw the people standing at the roof and we saw the cops. So we just came to get our stuff out of the building. So.
Yeah, they should have been having an event of their own.
Well, you know, you got to pay for
and the kind of largely unintelligible tape you hear now is
yesterday.
That's true.
Scouting around the back of the Woolworths building. We did eventually find the folks who were on top of the building.
So we're standing here back by the Pearl Alley Bistro, and we caught a quick glimpse of a man near a television antenna up here on the roof near Walnut Street. But it's a person anyway, somebody with a hood on. But there's a ways away. They're not really within hailing distance.
I don't know the name of the man, though. I don't.
So you were on the roof a moment ago? Or?
Yeah, I was on the roof.
How many folks were up there?
I'd say probably about 20 people, or more than that.
And for how long were you guys up there?
I don't remember, because I didn't get... myself, probably about 20 minutes. I wasn't up there very long.
And a festive occasion, I imagine?
Yes, for the millennial, definitely.
And what kind of music were you playing, or was being played?
Kind of, it was a bluesy type of, you know, rock. It was pretty nice. It was very good, actually. It was very good.
And how did this thing come to an end?
The police, of course, came up and asked questions and insisted that there was no permit and asked if we, which said that there were some complaints. And that's how it came to an end.
How many police officers actually responded?
There were three.
And did they make any arrests?
No, nothing like that. No, it was
no tickets.
Peaceful. No, nothing like that. It was all done very peacefully.
Still, they removed music from the downtown yet again.
Yes, again, unfortunately. And although it seemed that everyone else was enjoying it, they, of course, had their own agenda. So.
Your name is?
Indiana.
Hey, Indiana. Thank you for the update. Anything you want to add for...
Out with the old, in with the new for the millennium. I'll add that.
Whoa. Thank you.
Okay.
So, additionally, you were saying, Indiana, that some of these folks have permission to be up
there.
They
have permission to be up there. They work inside of the building. And have permission to be on top and to play their music. I guess they needed a permit or some sort or something like that, you know, a city permit.
And perhaps badges. They had no badges.
Yes, badges. If you had, I'm sure that would have gone over much better. A few badges.
Thank you, India.
You're welcome.
We're talking to a woman with a video camera who apparently was up on the roof checking out the scene. Your name?
Jeanette.
Jeanette, what cooked here?
Pardon me?
What cooked here?
What cooked here is we kind of did a Beatle kind of thing. We played up on the roof for a few songs, and somebody complained, and the cops came pretty quick.
And what did those officers of the law tell you?
I couldn't hear what they were saying. See, I'm not really the person you wanted to interview. You need to talk to one of the criminal geniuses in QSO. That's Quasi-Stellar Object.
I see. So that's the name of this musical group?
Yes, it is.
Cool. Thank you. Okay, we've got to the getaway car of...
Yeah.
What's your name?
My name's Guy.
And, Guy, what were you doing up at the height of a rooftop above us?
Just trying to say Happy New Year to all our friends here in Santa Cruz.
And what happened when you did?
Well, you know, the men in blue have a way of getting up there, too, so they found us up there and told us it was time to go home. Somebody complained, obviously.
How long did you were you able to do your singing up there?
Oh, probably about 20 minutes.
Well, it apparently created quite a stir, although some people didn't even notice it at all. I went around and asked people, one person after another, and there was some did, some didn't. Here.
Right on.
We're
going to
have to wait for a guy.
You want a hand over there?
That's actually, you could probably go in their truck.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you weren't threatened with tickets or jail?
No,
they were actually pretty mellow. Okay. But just somebody complained
here,
that was involved with the building, you know.
Yeah, I'll take some of that.
Were you invited to actually go up on the roof?
Yeah, actually, the bass player in the group here, he works here at the bazaar here. Mm-hmm. And his boss is the guy that actually is running the place. But he got complaints, and so he was a little concerned about the insurance, really.
I see. So how many of you were there up there?
Oh, probably 15.
Well, it certainly raised a smile on some lips.
Oh, yeah, it was a lot of fun.
The name of your group is?
It was, Boris Hell and the Chocolate Onions.
Mamma mia. Keep that in mind for next Millennium New Year's Day. Well, thank you, God. And,
hey, thank you.
I hope all is well in the next engagement.
Yes, we do. Right on. Thank you.
With Free Radio Santa Cruz, we're talking to...
Maturadish.
I see you have some literature here. Looks like a particular Eastern philosophy. My goodness, I can't pronounce these names. So give me a quick description.
Krishna.
Now, you were part of the... is this the Hare Krishna, Krishna, Krishna? How long have you been Krishnaing it up? I mean, how long have you been with the group?
Tickets for jaywalking on Pacific Avenue by two police officers who apparently have nothing better to do.
They are.
So
they are.
What's your name, sir?
Zip Zero Zilch.
Your name?
Mark.
Mark, what happened?
As far as I know, he walked across the street where cars were going. So they're giving all this energy to cars. They're saying cars are more than people.
Well, actually, I saw you walk across. Did you get a ticket or not?
No, they left me alone.
Okay, well, that's a step forward.
I'd just like to talk with you.
Tickets for jaywalking on Pacific Avenue, folks. The police department strikes again, getting rid of those serious crimes downtown. Tickets for jaywalking on Pacific Avenue. Santa Cruz Police Department at work.
And revenge. It happens all the time, but you guys are fucking so ignorant. You don't even...
Well, which free radio, Santa Cruz? We're talking to the man who got the jaywalking ticket. Your name,
yeah,
sir?
Yeah, I have 250 hours of community service hours I'm doing at the municipal wharf. I have took a week and a half off from the municipal wharf because I have been sick from an illness called a fever. I had
a
fever.
Take a deep breath. Go ahead.
You know what?
Hang on, let's finish with him first.
I was here on Church Street connecting to Pacific Avenue. Mm-hmm. And, I was here right in front of the new Cooper house, and I was,
talking to two of your friends.
I was talking to two of my friends, and the cops suspected something, and they stopped over them.
Two police officers stood across the street watching you for an extended period of time. We're actually standing about 15 or 20 feet from the bench where Robert Stephan is sitting with his umbrella.
And I was curious to know what they're talking to me about, and there's no cars coming. I looked both ways. And I walk right across the street, and the cop says, Okay, what's your name?
Was that the blonde officer or Officer Gallegos?
The blonde officer.
Yes,
Officer Gallegos. And he goes,
actually, Officer Gallegos was the other officer.
What's your name? Mm-hmm. And I said, my name is Sonny Harper. Uh-huh. And he said, well, I'm going to write you a ticket for jaywalking then.
Sounds like harassment to me.
And he says, the crosswalk was just right over there. And I said, but officer, I just came to talk to you, man. Jesus. I said, there's numerous people who cross across the street.
No, I've never seen a ticket been given for jaywalking on Pacific Avenue since 1990. But I would encourage you,
Listen. I've even jaywalked, whatever they call it. I've even jaywalked.
You're a sinner, I can see that. You're a major criminal. You're big time. Free Radio Santa Cruz, you're on the air.
Yes, I want to be off the air, though.
Uh-oh. Well, hang on.
Boy. Well, this is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3, and we're actually expecting a call-in from Suffern Bob, who does regular cop watching. But until we do, let's hear a little bit of the Capitol Steps.
So I'm wearing a cow costume, all right?
I lost my job and utter slob till someone said at Hudson there's an opening. Go to their plants and you'll advance to a whopper of a future at a Burger King. That's when I met this crazy nymphette. She got into my blood, hey, what delirium. We had an affair, but hey, I don't care if she's just some lousy low-life scum bacterium. Come to me, my swell E. coli baby.
Let's go sit on someone's bun.
Together we'll be dangerous and maybe everyone who eats me's gonna run. You know where the grief is, where the beef is. I'm not well done.
Should I say chow? Oh.
Don't end our affair.
What we're cooking up is rare. The next time you eat meat,
don't have a cow.
I'm gonna spoil you rotten.
And on the line with us is the inimitable Suffering Bob of Cop Watch. Hi, Bob.
How you doing, Robert?
I'm good. We've kind of given the entree, so you were checking out the scene on New Year's Eve.
I was, and I guess I'd like to preface any sort of report with saying that I'm just overjoyed that there wasn't any major incidents of violence on New Year's Eve. And, you know, I think that was probably the most surprising part of New Year for me. I was really expecting, the apocalypse and the end of the world as we know it and all kinds of craziness, especially downtown.
Give it a few more months, you know.
Yeah, we'll see. But anyway, it was great to see that the police behaved and that everybody else behaved and we're able to celebrate the new year instead of having a tragedy on our hands, so...
Well, that sounds good. I know you set off at 5 o'clock in the evening from the Rise Zone with a notebook and camera.
Yeah, and tape recorder, and we didn't get to ride our bicycles this watch because the streets were closed to bicycles, which is it's a way we like to transport ourselves, sustainable transportation.
So instead you used your little personal helicopters, right?
Yeah, we have the jet packs going left.
Uh-huh. But actually, that made it kind of hard for you to get around, right?
It does. It definitely does.
Because there were a lot of crowds, and I guess you said you were telling me police were everywhere, and they quickly dealt with whatever they were dealing with before you could get there. Right?
Their response times were unbelievable. The standard response time in this city is 3 to 5 minutes on an incident. And I would say on New Year's night, it was anywhere from 15 seconds to a minute. And just to give you an example, we were down on Laurel Street, and what's going on? There's a cruiser that went by, and then 15 other police officers running down the street to respond.
15.
It was just insane. And this is just like a block away from Bonesio's, where they had a few different teams located, so I guess the two teams must have heard some kind of disturbance over the radio.
It certainly contrasts with what happened at Benicio's, 2 months ago when Trollbusters beat up people who looked homeless on a number of Tuesday nights in that area. There were a series of beatings. And I guess you didn't hear about anybody being beaten up by either Trollbusters or police on the New Year's Eve, right?
I didn't.
That's good.
But I did see a lot of strange activity going on for the hours before darkness on the last night of 1999. I witnessed a few occasions where the homeless, the visibly homeless, were being rounded up off the streets and transported to the jail.
Tell me about that.
Well, I'll describe one incident that happened probably about 2:25. Mm-hmm. Right outside the Blue Lagoon, we heard a call about two people who were 647S. That's the radio code for people being on dope. I'm not sure if it was F or S. F is being drunk, F is being on dope. And I don't even know what they mean by dope. You know, it carries several connotations. Anyway, apparently it's illegal to be intoxicated and on the streets in this town, and they were using that as a general clause for picking people up off the streets and getting them off. And I don't know if they did their standard 5 to 6 hours in the dry tank or if they were actually arrested for the whole night. But this happened, it was Officer Hennig, so I mean there was a little bit of apprehension there because of his history.
Sergeant Hobo Hunter Hennig, I
Yeah, Officer 111. And at that point, Officer 191, John Bush, was driving the police van around. Later on that night, it was Officer Connor Carey driving the police van. And
that's Connor Carey, the killer of Happy John Dine.
Yeah. Usually he does the alcohol task force, but...
Did he behave properly?
He was... I guess he behaved properly. You know, he's kind of excited when he saw that we were walking around videotaping and taking accounts.
Did he come over and try to get your autograph?
Or? No. I think he was wanting us to ask him for his.
I see.
But it's...
Well, the last time I saw Officer Carey was when he was confronted by my producer, Becky Johnson. He'd come into the Loudon Nelson Park at night, and he was harassing, he was one of a team of people, I guess, that was harassing three skateboarders.
Wow.
And in the park after dark, but of course, this was a park that's right next to Loudon Nelson Center, which was open at that time, so it wasn't actually illegal to be there. They attempted to get us all to leave, and we said no, and
right.
Eventually they left, so. Anyway, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I just wanted to let you know about that, that which happened. And, you know, we heard on the radio several reports of similar instances happening around the city. So, you know, I don't know what we do about that. You know, I'm sure that's an order that came down from the top. You know, let's get all the drunks off the street so to make room for the rich drunks.
Let me ask you about that, because, you know, I mean, supposedly this is one of the big deals about First Night is the mythology behind it is it's supposed to stop the kind of drunken rioting that happened New Year's Eve 1993-94.
Right.
And, of course, that was not, you know, that was prompted by Lieutenant Saponi then. I know she was a Sergeant Saponi then, but she actually moved in early with her riot squad to start hitting the knuckles of people with her batons at the town clock at 12:10. Clock didn't officially close as a gathering point until 1 o'clock, and then she herded everybody downtown where they broke windows, and as far as I know, she's never had any disciplinary consequences to pay for that we know.
Oh, on the contrary, you know, if you're an officer on the Santa Cruz Police Force and you shoot or beat or kill, that's an instant promotion on this force. That's, you know, you're not going to get reprimanded for that. They get promoted for that.
It's interesting that has happened. At least I don't know if Connor. I guess Connor Carey he hasn't been promoted in terms of he hasn't become a sergeant. But I think I heard something about his getting a different detail. Do you know anything about that? Whether he got a change in detail from several years ago?
He's one of the officers in charge of the alcohol task force now, and he's one of the officers who sets up the stings for.
Now, is that a higher position in some sense? Is it more money per hour? Or?
That's a good question. That I don't know.
I know that one of the things that concerned me, before I get into that, I was going to talk about the amount of money that was expended, the amount of money went to the merchants, and the amount of police overtime, huge amounts of overtime that happened. But,
right.
But again, the origins of First Night lie in this idea of making it an alcohol-free kind of thing. And I wonder, was First Night alcohol-free? I went home about 8:30. I didn't notice a lot of drinking. Did you notice a lot of middle-class drinking?
I noticed a ton of middle-class drinking. In fact, it was interesting. There was a group of young women, you know, dressed festively. They were wearing probably shorter skirts. They were beautiful women walking down the street.
Get over it, Bob.
Two of them stumbled right in front of the cops and did nothing about it, whereas, you know, earlier that day we were witnessing just people standing on the street being rounded up.
Who were homeless looking.
So there's definitely a classist approach that was happening that night. And closer to midnight, everybody was drunk down there. No,
really?
No, it was 2,000.
This is an alcohol-free event.
No.
Come on. Our city mothers and fathers have assured us that this is a way to avoid Lieutenant Saponi's going bananas and forcing everybody downtown so they break windows.
It's nice if people want to believe that it was an alcohol-free event, but that's just ridiculous.
Did you see a lot of other police jurisdictions out on the street?
Yeah, definitely. We saw people from state parks, from the fire department, from Watsonville Police Department, Scotts Valley Police Department. Well, those are the major jurisdictions that I witnessed. I'm trying to remember if there's anybody else.
You said that it was largely violence-free as far as you could tell, but of course the problem you had was that you didn't. Usually, when a violent incident happens, it takes a little time.
Right.
People can come to the scene. There are witnesses to observe. I imagine all that was much more difficult on New Year's Eve. First, because there was such a crunch of people and people going from one direction to another, and second, because you say police acted so quickly because there were so many of them.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, you know, in a way, you might say, well, more police in some way may, in fact, cut down on the amount of violence. But unfortunately, there is a trade-off there. And the trade-off has to do with the question of whether you want a police state, whether you want a police officer in every corner, whether you want to have, as they say that one way to stop, for example, drinking is to, you know, cut off a person's hand if they drink. Saudi Arabia, they have severe laws about drinking, and I think, you know, maybe it's true upper-class people drink in private. There ain't too much drinking on the streets in
Right.
Saudi Arabia, I've heard. And so if you really want to institute a real police state, you can, in fact, deal with things like, I guess, the drug war. But the question is, do you want to do that? And I guess my answer is always, no way.
Right.
Bob, I appreciate your calling in. For folks who want to be a part of Cop Watch, you want to talk a little bit about it and how they can join up?
Well, certainly. I encourage them to come down and spend a meeting with us.
We meet every Wednesday night at the Rhizone Info Shop, which is on Walnut Street. I forget the number. Was it?
224. 224 Walnut.
So we meet from 7:30, or 7:30 to 9, approximately 9:30. So come on down. We'll tell you about what's going on and what our initiatives are this year. And we're really excited about providing this necessary component to the community.
Is there a phone number people can call to get more
information? Not yet. We're still working on securing the number, but if we do have an email account, if somebody wants some information, they can send us an email at copwatchsantacruz@hotmail.com. It's all lowercase, no space. So, yeah, that's a great way to get in touch with us.
And as usual, we are running up against time. We have about half an hour left in Bathrob Spear's Broadsides. I'm your host, Bathrob Spear Robert Norse, and we're going to quickly give you an update on the Homeless Issues Task Force after this phone call. Hi, you're on free radio.
Hi. I don't know what happened, but during that interview with Seth from Bob, the signal just totally dropped out.
Wow. So we're not going out?
Well, we are now. I don't understand it. It was really weird. I know it's not my Walkman's batteries because I hear myself talking now, but I don't know what happened.
Very strange. Nothing happened here in the studio of any note. It was just
the needle swinging when you were talking to him?
It was a little low, but he was very loud on the phone.
So. Yeah, he was loud, and then you were really low, and now then it just dropped out altogether. That was weird.
Well,
I don't know what happened. I'm hearing it now, so I guess everything's okay.
You get to hear our station in operation here, folks. This is a people's station. Can you dig it?
All right. Well, I guess I'll let you get to that. Whatever it was you're getting to.
I will.
Goodbye.
Thanks, Vinny. Our 24-hour technicians never rest and frequently get arrested, but that's another story. Phone number for Free Radio Santa Cruz is 427-3772. Briefly about the Homeless Issues Task Force. This is the group that unanimously recommended at its last, its's early December meeting on December 6th, that City Council realize that only 20% of the homeless people are sheltered at best in the winter, that there's been violence, that there has been six homeless deaths, that there has been declared shelter emergencies have been ignored, and that resolution after resolution has been ignored from the Homeless Issues Task Force itself to the City Council. So they asked City Council to suspend the sleeping and camping bans, the laws that make it illegal to shelter yourself, to put up a tent, the laws that make it illegal to sleep at night, until such time as City Council sets up safe sleeping zones. And they realized that there probably wasn't a majority on City Council to pass this, but they felt it was so important that they wanted Keith Sugar, the new mayor, to put it on the agenda just so it could be talked about, just so that the community could come to some understanding of what was going on. Even if he was voted down, the community would be educated, and those who voted against it would, in essence, be shamed. And the community could then start responding and letting the council know its wishes on this. Unfortunately, Mayor Sugar chose another path. Though he came to the first Homeless Issues Task Force meeting to sort of schmooze with the folks at the meeting as the new mayor, and said, bring stuff to me. The next day, when the Homeless Issues Task Force brought their unanimous recommendation on December 7th to his office, he simply closed the door on any discussion of the sleeping ban, on any possibility of putting it on the agenda. And in fact, he closed down discussion of that until November 2000. In essence, he said, I don't want this to be talked about until November 2000 because I don't have the votes. Now, they told him, I believe, the representatives who came and spoke to him, at least they said this at the meeting the day before, that they knew that Sugar didn't necessarily have the votes, but what he did have was the power of the mayorship. He did have the power to agendaize items. He did have the power to speak to the community from a position of some authority and some responsibility. And also, as a man who had worked on the issue with some experience the winter before, he refused to do all of these things. We have an incoming call.
Hi, you're on Fear Radio.
I just wanted to say briefly, Robert, you're kidding.
I'm sorry?
You're joking.
Tell me. I'm joking about what, Bob?
That you would seriously consider that the entrenched power in Santa Cruz is going to rock the boat on the sleeping ban.
Well,
I find that amazing, and I've said this before.
Right, well,
I just want to get this out.
I'm not the only one who thought this way. There were 10 members of the Homeless Issues Task Force that wanted Sugar to do this.
It is so predictable, this whole spin-out
right. On
this particular issue.
But as you know, it's a human rights issue.
And
we have to press it.
You're just now saying you heard from Mr. Sugar that this is not going to come up again by his...
Well, no, he didn't tell me that. Sugar doesn't talk to me, but that's what I heard secondhand, yes.
November 2000.
Right.
So... In essence, what was done was it was put off until it might become an election issue.
Well, or as I put it in the article I wrote for Street Spirit, maybe they can sleep next November.
So I just wanted to say that my you're kidding. I mean that this would actually that the elected leadership in Santa Cruz would actually take a position on this issue, other than that things should remain the same.
Well, thank you, Bob.
You bet.
And, of course, Bob's skepticism is quite appropriate. The reason that we thought, the reason that Sugar and Crone were approached, and particularly Sugar, is one, he was the mayor, and there had been a change in the power structure insofar as he had become mayor, supplanting the old mayor, Sleeping Ban Byers, as we called her, because she was the key vote a year ago that killed any real change in the sleeping ban. And Sugar himself a year ago had made a proposal that there be no ticketing unless there's a health and safety concern. And, of course, when Byers and Rotkin and Barisoni, the city attorney, struck him down on that, he kind of retired into his chambers like a wounded kitty and didn't come out. But as mayor, we felt he had the responsibility to speak on it. Indeed, that is why the Homeless Issues Task Force came forward and asked him to speak.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
And, oh, we wish he would speak about the sleeping ban. I wanted to talk about the homeless deaths you mentioned earlier, and by the way, it was a vast undercount. You said 6 homeless deaths.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have the list.
Well, there were 6 in 3 months, is what I was saying.
There were actually closer to 12, and from the time when the first meeting was held at the Homeless Issues Task Force until the end of 99, there were 12 homeless deaths.
That's new to me.
In fact, we have the list that just recently came out on December 21st with the Homeless Services Center, which had compiled a list with some help from Huff and the Santa Cruz County Coroner's Office. And that list has 18 deaths, considerably up from the average 10 or 12 a year that's been reported by the Santa Cruz County Coroner.
So there have been 18 deaths since January 1999, and you say there have been 12 deaths since August of 99?
Right.
Wow. I had heard that there was 5 deaths and then 6 between September and December, and I don't disbelieve you. I just haven't heard those.
And the latest death, of course, which took place the day before Christmas Eve, up on the armory floor, was Will Rush, died age 57 and of an apparent heart attack.
Or of just being homeless, you might say. A lot of that, the pressures of being homeless, of course, you know, everything starts to go. You have to walk around an incredible amount. You're much more subject to disorders of the feet and legs, and not to mention hypothermia, and of course the other
coincident problems that developed. But, yeah, did you want to... I was kind of giving this update on the Homeless Issues Task Force.
Well, I think that the emergency resolution that came out of the Homeless Issues Task Force to suspend the sleeping and camping ban until safe zones can be established, that the reason that they considered an emergency was because of the lack of shelter, because of the homeless beatings, and because there a sharp rise in homeless deaths.
Definitely.
Thanks.
Sure. And again, continuing this this saga of what happened, on December 6th, this resolution unanimously passed the Homeless Issues Task Force, including the vote of Peter Eberle, who is the head of the Downtown Association. And I was dumbfounded at this and very impressed at the same time. And I don't know, you know, what this means for his tenure on the Downtown Association. I still don't know. I think he takes definitely a much more conservative view, and why he voted on this issue that way, I don't know. But it was a unanimous vote. Suspend the sleeping and camping ordinances until safe zones can be set up. Have the mayor immediately respond to this and put it on the agenda. So Chair Linda LeMaster and several members of the committee went and met with Sugar. He refused to do it. And then Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and other members of the Homeless Issues Task Force began to call in. And we spoke, some of us, to Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, which just come back, some of them from Seattle, and urged them to call the city council, since maybe if the council wouldn't listen to us, or Sugar wouldn't listen to us, Mayor Sugar, that they would listen to those older women who, and their wisdom and their own perspective, which they're closer politically to the council than many of us are. And indeed, apparently, this is a flood of calls, and Sugar apparently, according to David Silva, told him there were hundreds of calls, and that's, which I'm impressed with that. Sugar then held an emergency meeting on Sunday night, kind of a secret surprise meeting, and as it's been called by Becky Johnson, who heard about it and got to it, even though she wasn't invited to it, took extensive minutes at it. And at that meeting, Crone and Sugar were there for most of the meeting, and then Fitzmaurice showed up at the end. And I guess some of the what I call the kitchen cabinet of Sugar, which included Fred Geiger, Susan Martinez, Ed Porter, and some members of the Homeless Issues Task Force, including Linda LeMaster, were there. And Sherry Connable, I believe, was at that meeting as well. And essentially, Sugar was told that by at least half the people in the room, and I've done a very careful study of that, even though Fred Geiger, who may be listening to this show, takes issue with my figures, half of them said, put this item on the agenda, suspending the sleeping and camping ordinances, as even just a moral issue, if nothing else, including Bernice Belton, an old stalwart of SCAN, Santa Cruz Action Network. And Sugar just said, no, I won't do it. But what I will do is I'll respond to oral communications issues. And yet, of course, when oral communications came around 2 days later, because this meeting took place on the Sunday before the last council meeting in December, he said nothing. And no other council members said anything either. It has to also be said that there was a lot of pressure on the Homeless Issues Task Force of different sorts. One member of the task force, who since, as I understand, has resigned, was running around telling people not to present this at city council because she didn't like some of the people who were doing the presenting and she didn't think it had been authorized. It had, in fact, been agreed to several sessions before that oral communications was an appropriate place to bring up this issue. And since it was an emergency, there was no other place to bring it up. And indeed, it was brought up in somewhat haphazard and fashion, but still... Sugar not only didn't respond to it, he cut me short on at least three occasions on homeless issues, completely refused to hear oral communications from myself and Dan Hopkins, and misinformed Roxana Kistapache on issues of Dolphin Lee when that came up at the council. Dolphin Lee is an issue we're going to be talking about next. We did begin to talk about it last time, and I'm hoping we can get a call or two from folks who are interested in the issue. Dolphin Lee is a two apartment complexes in the beach flats, Dolphin and Lee Apartments, which have been targeted by Mayor Byers for demolition and rehabilitation, rebuilding a $5 million project, which will essentially eradicate the people who are living there now in terms of their inhabiting those complexes and put in a new, probably less Hispanic, more upscale set of individuals who can't afford to, who can afford the increased rents. And Roxana Kistapache, who's an activist down there, along with Phil Bear and others, have brought out repeatedly that there are other ways of getting affordable housing than giving a huge chunk of money to Mercy Housing, evicting a whole bunch of people, hundreds, literally hundreds of Hispanic people who are in a tight-knit family. And we heard Phil Bear talk about this last time. And then essentially giving them relocation money that won't pay for their housing in Santa Cruz. They can't possibly pay for their housing in Santa Cruz. It's essentially something that we've recognized for a year, and we thought was part of the kind of the original plan, do the similar kind of relocation sleight of hand with the beach plan, the beach redevelopment, Third Street realignment plan. And that one got kicked in the ass by the voters down the road. Now it's come up again, this time with the sponsorship of Mayor Byers, and also apparently votes from Sugar and Crone. And another thing that's upset a lot of us is a lot of this has happened in closed session. That is to say, not really in closed session, that's not accurate, with a kind of a closed process. There's been no real public debate on Dolphin Lee versus other alternatives, either at SCAN, in its meetings, or in the city council. And people have been warning, Phil Bear notably, Scott Graham as well, activists who are not they're closer to the city council than I am, but they're not so close that they're wrapped up in a tautological embrace so that they can't say anything but wait till next November when we get a majority and we'll start talking. These men at least are talking now. They have made it, they've been warning that the council is not using a public process. And by the council, we don't just mean the evil Mike Rotkin and the nasty Michael Hernandez, who it's okay to boo at, because you have the new council majority, supposedly. We're talking about the council majority, Fitzmaurice, Crone, Sugar, and Byers, who are ramming this sucker down Santa Cruz's throat. Last council meeting, it was a $54,000 appropriation that went for this this thing. And they are not giving it much public process. That seems to be the bottom line. And I'm hoping we can get a phone call or two on this issue. I also want to mention, however, before we run out of time, just quickly, there is a Parks and Rec Commission meeting for the city tomorrow at 4 o'clock at City Council Chambers. That's where City Hall City Council meetings usually are. It'll be happening at 4 o'clock. And involved in that meeting, you can come and talk about opening up the parks to for homeless people if you'd like. That certainly should be an alternative that the parks are used for in winter. If there's no safe or legal places to sleep, that can be done at Oral Communications, which is the beginning of the agenda. You can also talk about the Poganip Clubhouse Rehabilitation Plan, where they're spending tens of thousands of dollars to rehabilitate the Poganip Clubhouse. But how much money are they spending for low-income people in the parks? Not much. Then they're also discussing the annual budget tomorrow, and there's an appeal to the Loudon Nelson Hallway Gallery. This is a question of censoring the paintings that are in the gallery, and you probably read about this in the Sentinel. It's an issue that I haven't followed very closely, but it may be of interest, and they're putting it on the agenda for a half-an-hour discussion. After that, there's a heritage tree permit for all of you environmental buffs. And apparently there's a revision to the Heritage Tree Ordinance, and then the San Lorenzo River has a task force update. So you might want to check that out. That's Parks and Rec Commission tomorrow, City Hall at 4 o'clock. City Council has a special meeting on January 4th. No, this is not a special meeting about the homeless, as we have asked the council to do. And indeed, various members went to City Council and asked them to, we also asked Sugar to put this item on as an emergency agenda item. Since he refused to do it as a regular agenda item, we asked him to try to get the 5 votes to put it on as an emergency item back on the 14th, even after oral communications. And even if he couldn't do it, at least he could raise it as an issue. He could make the public aware that it's something he wanted done, that he felt had to be done. He was being stopped by the rest of the council. But no, he wouldn't do that. And so now we've asked Sugar, and you've heard this on my show, to call a special session. That's the kind of session that, for example, they are calling, but not for homelessness, of course, on January 4th, 2 days from today. That's on Tuesday. On Tuesday at 7 o'clock, there will be a special session. They're going to hear an appeal of a zoning board parcel. Mr. Crocker is the owner of that. They're going to hear a genetic modification labeling controversy. There's going to be a budget adjustment on the Washington Street property, all of which have nothing to do, of course, with homelessness, and they haven't even put on the agenda what their own $10,000 Homeless Issues Task Force asked them to put on. Sugar is bankrupt at this point, as far as I'm concerned. And I'd like to hear from any members of the public on this. We, as usual, are up against the wire. I don't know why I can't budget my time better on the show, but I'm stuck with that. I'm going to try to put through a quick call to Fred Geiger, who is, perhaps he can give me a call. It'd be easier and quicker, Fred, if you're listening on the radio, 427-3772. That's the phone number here in the studio, in case you're at the radio and listening in. We'll give you a few seconds to see if you're going to be responding to that. And if not, we'll try and give you a call. Maybe that's the best thing to do. I'll try and give Fred a call here. And we'll see what we get here. Yep, got a busy signal. I think he's trying to call us. We'll let you call us. We'll wait on that one. A couple of other things that we're going to try to dash through quickly. A lot of hype in the Sentinel, of course, as usual, about the New Year's Eve and the terrorist threat, and I've talked about that. The phony celebration that happens around New Year's, but the real issues, of course, don't get talked about. And they don't get talked about during the old year either, as we saw. Sugar wouldn't talk about the old issue. Now, on the 11th, there's supposed to be the Homeless Issues Task Force report coming up. And that's the midterm report. And that's going to be a whole bunch of stuff, and no doubt there'll be a small amount of time apportioned to that. But the real issue, which was an emergency action, which the Homeless Issues Task Force unanimously voted, this city council showed where it was at. They didn't even have the courage to talk about it. It's a disgrace. I mean, that's all I can say. And the sad thing that I saw that was the follow-up on this was that the Homeless Issues Task Force, instead of responding to this at its last meeting by holding a press conference or planning a protest or resigning, which I think is what they should do, because if they're not going to be taken seriously, if their matters aren't being put on the agenda, if they're going to be sidelined and a back room to death, they need to stand up publicly for the constituency that they're supposedly working for, the homeless community in Santa Cruz, and speak out. And that's the best thing they can do. That kind of embarrassment is what the council needs to hear. That kind of the strong message is what the community needs to hear, and then, of course, the community needs to contact the council. So I encourage you to give a call to the council at 420-5020, 420-5020, and that you should ask them to call a special session, suspend the sleeping and camping ordinance, suspending safe zones, or give us another solution for people who are out there. If you don't want to do that, do something else, but do something. And I am still getting a busy. I hope that Fred hasn't taken his phone off the hook. Boy, that would be embarrassing. I'll assume not. Fred's a very articulate fellow. Don't always agree with him on the issues, but he presents a very, very well-reasoned, often moderate series of proposals. And when we've spoken, I guess I'm going to have to kind of put this forward. Fred suggested that what's needed is a very specific proposal for parking structures to be opened up to the homeless and campground, perhaps, and that should be on the agenda at the very latest by first session in February, the last session in January, because the armory will close, and when the armory closes, there's a 95% of the homeless instead of 80% of the homeless are out of luck and criminalized at night if the police choose to ticket them, and they can harass them at will and often do. Of course, the problem there is that this is the same thing as last year. Why one should wait and wait and wait, and the argument that was used that Fred suggested to me the other day was, well, they can always say that there's a space or two at the armory left and therefore they don't have to take any action. No, that whole thing has been discredited by the Homeless Issues Task Force, and it's also been discredited by the task force to examine the camping ordinance, which Crone, Sugar, and Byers headed last winter. I think the real problem is that Fred and his constituents are afraid to put pressure on the city council, and specifically on Sugar and Byers and Fitzmaurice and Crone, because they see it as some sort of political issue instead of being a human rights issue. If it's a human rights issue, it's something you press to do because it's right, not as to whether, and this is something David Silva, I think, really rightfully pointed out, not because you're expending political capital if you do it. You know, no, you're not expending political capital to try to do the right thing. It's an issue of moral principle, that you don't arrest people for sleeping, that you don't make them make women outside more vulnerable, as the Commissioner for the Prevention of Violence Against Women has officially told the City Council back in February why they supported ending the sleeping ban, was because it makes it unsafer for women outside, because they can't sleep in groups, they can't sleep in well-lit areas, they can't sleep where the police can more easily patrol, because they have to worry about camping tickets and camping warrants. And, of course, complete police disinterest in beatings, as we found was the case in the beating of the man named Carl when he was beaten out on Mission Street 7-Eleven in late November. He called the police, and they arrested him and took him to jail because he was drunk. They wouldn't take a report even though he was bleeding, even though his assailants were nearby, and they released him at 1:30 into the pouring rain from the jail onto the sidewalk. So these kinds of obscenities are what we are forced to contend with. And my thought has always been there has to be a community response, since the council refuses to respond. And I'm talking about a response from not just people who are sympathetic with homeless people, but hey, all you renters out there. I mean, are you enjoying these high rents? Are you enjoying the council indifference to the issue of rent control, to the issue of speculation? Are you just going to sit there while they kind of move you out of town? I mean, are you going to just sort of wait until you get sick, until you end up on the streets in a car and then get arrested for sleeping and have your vehicle towed? That happens, you know. It doesn't necessarily happen in every case, but it creates a climate of fear. It creates a climate of a kind of a police state, because the police can determine who they want to do that to. And it just puts you in a position where you lose a lot of your dignity as a human being. And you, even if you're not homeless, you have to become afraid of being homeless. So it's a real question. I'm going to try old Fred again, see if we can get through on the line here. Now, since Fred's been informed that we're trying to reach him, I guess I have to assume that maybe there's an important call that's come in on his phone, or possibly he doesn't want to talk on this issue at this time. And indeed, if I were close to Cronin Sugar, I might be embarrassed, too, about the issue. I'll tell you, if the politicians I supported at the last election were doing to homeless people... Wait a minute, there's an incoming call. Will I have to eat my words? Nope, the caller hung up. I really want to apologize. Another call coming in. And again, a hang-up. I want to apologize to those trying to reach the show so late, because we don't really have the time. I'm going to have to run in about 4 minutes. The show does return on Thursday at 6 o'clock, and the City Council meeting, as I mentioned before, there is going to be the City Council meeting at 7 o'clock on Tuesday. It does not have an oral communications period, however, so if you want to speak to the Council, you have to talk on the items on the agenda, and it looks like there are three of them on the agenda. Property resolution adopting a negative declaration, a zoning board parcel business, which I can't make heads or tails of, genetic engineering stuff, which I guess makes more sense to me, I followed that, and something about property assembly in the Washington Street Pacific Area Wharf intersection, $25,000, connection with the multimodal public park and museum project. But that doesn't mean you can't come with a sleeping bag or a sign, if you're so inclined. And I don't know what the best way to deal with this issue is, you know. I think we probably need the kind of action that Seattle got back in November and December, because, I say, if a fifth of the Santa Cruz activists who went to Seattle were willing to do the same thing here in Santa Cruz for the sleeping ban, to restore human rights to homeless people, we would see some very significant action by City Council. And we would see some significant press coverage on the issue as well. Well, I am going to get ready to leave, even though it looks like my next talk show host, the Little Red Hen, has not yet made it to the studio. She's occasionally a little bit late. I'll quickly do an update before I take off on the involuntary outpatient commitment stuff that is really... frightened me, and I think a number of people properly so. It's being considered in California, I guess, in January and February. When combined with the Needles on Wheels program, it's quite a serious thing. It means if you don't take your meds, they put you in the hospital. Is fundamentally what it means. And they can essentially forcibly medicate you and then dump you in the ward if you don't accept these medications. And here's the latest from the internet on that issue. There is a full-scale attack on the rights of people with mental disabilities throughout the nation. The goal of this campaign is to expand forced mental health treatment. Current California law, the Lanterman, Petras, and Short Act, allows involuntary commitment of people who, as a result of a mental disorder, are in danger to themselves or others or are gravely disabled. And we'll have to talk about this more next time because we're being invaded by the chickens, and we are going to have to get chicken and get out of here. And I think I'm going to actually give you 30 seconds of that minute to take over the scene, man. Come on back next Thursday. Bathrobe Spears Broadsides will return. And until then, stay with us on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Thanks for being with us. You guys got tapes, or shall I babble on a bit here? No, there's no way to stop these two, man. They are deadly. So hang with them.